Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg.
And I'm Amanda Borchel Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East,
and the Jewish world.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Briefing. Today is Tuesday, August 2nd. I'm Ann Gordon, in for Amanda Borchel Dunn, here today with senior analyst Chaviv Rettig-Gor and environment reporter Sue Sirks. Hello to you both.
Good morning.
Hey guys, good morning.
Today, the second day of August, confirms that the cost of living is on the rise. I checked several supermarkets, online that is, and the price of milk has indeed gone up, though not quite by the 4.9% that was reported last week, or not at the places that I checked. Likewise, I've become a little hyperconscious about our home electricity use in the hopes of not feeling that 8.6% increase when the bill comes. And yet, the price of gasoline is down, public transportation as well, and the large food importers are holding off with their price hikes. We'll hear what is going on and what hidden factors are messing with the Israeli cost of living. We'll also hear about how satellite data is being used to measure how much carbon is being captured out of the air, as well as the more down-to-earth road diet that's proposed for one of Jerusalem's thoroughfares in the hopes of reducing pollution and congestion. Starting with you, Chaviv, would you shed some light on these changing costs of living?
Yeah, I mean, as you said, cost of living is rising enormously. Even the, you know, the drop in the cost of gasoline is essentially a government subsidy. It's not permanent, it's not sustainable. It has a lot more to do with the fact that we're in the middle of an election campaign than anything else. What I want to focus on, though, is this very interesting phenomenon we've seen over the last week that really unpacks an important thing about the Israeli economy and how Israel is run and why everything in Israel is 30% more expensive than the average prices in the European Union or in places with higher GDP per capita, wealthier countries. Last month, over the course of July, the three major importers into Israel, three companies called Diplomat, Shastovitz, and Kimberly-Clark Israel, announced that they would be raising prices significantly on most of their products. And most of their products is most of the shelf space in most Israeli supermarkets. In other words, most Israeli products, and they were talking about increases of 10%, 20%. These are products in every single home. Kimberly-Clark is Huggies diapers in Israel. Diplomat is Starkist tuna, Pampers, Oreos. And what's interesting about these major importers is just how, even though there are several of them, they function are like a monopoly. They don't compete amongst themselves. Some companies actually own their own competition. Diplomat imports both Tide laundry detergent and Ariel laundry detergent, two major competing brands in the supermarket shelves that, in fact, are literally sold by the exact same company and so are not, in fact, competing. And what the companies have said, of course, is that they have no choice. There's global inflation. There's this enormous rise in the cost of shipping due to gas prices, pandemic supply chain problems, raw goods cost more. The Ukraine war has sent up the price of wheat, and wheat has driven the prices of many other things. The problem is, with these arguments, that, as I said, first of all, before this price increase, before any of these factors, Israelis already paid more for these products than in Europe. But the other problem is Shastovitz and Kimberly-Clark are privately owned companies. We don't have their quarterly reports. We don't know how much revenue and how much profit they make. But in 2020, Diplomat became publicly traded. And we have the last few quarterly reports of Diplomat, including the first quarter of this year of 2022. And those quarterly reports show a very sharp increase in profit. Now, they show a sharp increase in profit to the point where in April, they gave from those profits tens of millions of shekels in dividends to shareholders. They tried to, they had those massive profits, gave a huge amount in dividends, even after in February, they said the same thing about raising prices, said, you know, made the same excuses, explained that their costs were rising hugely, and then failed to raise many of those prices because there was a public uproar and actually a public boycott of their pasta brands and a few other things. So we know that from the one company that's publicly traded whose documents we have, that these arguments, these claims, these price rises have nothing to do with the actual factors in the market. That's not to say there aren't price rises in the market, but do they justify 20% rises in these in this incredibly concentrated market with very, very little competition? The bottom line, And we've seen this over the last month, and now we're seeing this tremendous reaction from politicians, from the public, from the business journals, commentators, economic commentators. We're seeing this enormous blowback against these companies, and the blowback is not about the specific increase in prices. It's about the fact that the Israeli economy is not a free market. There isn't free competition. These very few companies control huge amounts of market share. They don't actually have to literally call each other and coordinate monopolistic practices in illegal ways. They can simply not lower prices, and everybody understands that it's in their best interests. And every product line you follow, two, three companies control 85-90% of the market. Diplomat and Shostovitz and Kimberly-Clark are 85% of the diaper market. Elektra and Tadiran, the two Israeli brands, are 80% of the air conditioning market. Diplomat alone controls 80-90% of the razors market, the shaving razors. And so they can raise prices completely irrespective of actual costs, because there's no real competition, there's no alternative in the supermarket, and there's no alternative, not because their products are the best, but because their products are protected. I want to say two really quick things. I'm coming to a close. The reason their products are protected is twofold. One is this shocking institution called the Israeli Standards Institute. We've mentioned a little bit in the podcast, and we've written about it in the Times of Israel. Israel has a standards institute which creates safety standards for products. But it works differently from how other standards institutes around the world work. For almost every product, In the rest of the world, there's this effort to standardize standards. What that means is the European Union has standards for the safety requirements of, let's say, deodorants. And the United States has standards for how safe deodorants have to be and what safety means in a deodorant product. And they try and coordinate to make those the same standards so that it's very, very easy. If French standards, you know, French safety authorities can stamp a piece of deodorant as kosher, as safe, then you can import it to America without, you know, sitting 6 weeks in the port to get chemically tested to make sure it meets America's standards. Israel refuses to standardize. The most egregious example that came up over the last 2 weeks is school backpacks. Here again, Kalgav, Modan, two small companies control 90% of the market. They created a special safety standard. They sit in the Standards Institute, the public regulating institution of consumer safety, has the major companies that make backpacks in Israel sitting on the committee. It's a 5-member committee. I think two or three of the members are the industry. And they sit on that committee and they create a special standard called orthopedic. And they create special, specific needs. Now, no backpack maker anywhere in the world will change their line, their production line, for the tiny Israeli market. And so what they've effectively done by creating a special Israeli standard that is set by the industry is that it's almost impossible to import French backpacks, American backpacks, German backpacks, backpacks that are definitely safe. But what's fascinating about backpacks as a product isn't that there are safety standards in Europe and safety standards in Israel and they're different. It's that there are no safety standards anywhere else in the world for backpacks. Nowhere else on earth are backpacks considered a product that is dangerous and requires special government regulation to make them safe, except Israel. And it is a standard set essentially not by the people we taxpayers pay to look after our safety, but they have outsourced it to the industry, which uses it as a protectionist measure. Air conditioners. In air conditioners, the two major Israeli companies, Tadiran and Elektra, sit on the Standards Institute Committee for Air Conditioners, and they have written into Israeli safety standards a fire safety wrapper on the inside of an air conditioner that is mandatory so that your air conditioner doesn't set on fire. This is not required in Europe. This is not required in America. Very, very few air conditioners are setting fire to French homes. And the fact that we have this requirement means that it's very hard to import from overseas. And so it's a protectionist measure forced on us by the local companies. And so what you actually end up having, welcome to Israel, the Israeli standards, safety standards authority actually outsources to our local industries the ability to turn our entire economy protectionist. And that means that our prices aren't just higher than Europe. They say you're an island economy, you're small, you have to import everything in the port through the port. Folks, Israel's prices are higher than New Zealand, which has the same GDP per capita and which has to import everything even farther. So that's the story. Luckily, it's election season. Economy Minister Ona Berbivai last week announced the cancellation of air conditioning standards, standards for tampons, cleaning solutions, condoms, a whole range of products. This is now leading the news. I have to add one tiny disclaimer. My wife is an attorney who works in a public lobbying group that is fighting these standards, which is why I'm familiar with this issue. It's why I care passionately. I've come to care passionately about it. And it's why everyone should. It is now a major debate in all of Israel's business journals. And hopefully the fact that these people tried to raise prices right on election season is going to come back to bite them in the behind.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
Why has there been no political will to change this? I mean, the high prices in Israel have been an issue for years and years.
You know, that's a fascinating question. The system has been in place for decades. And my wife works on this in an organization called Lobby 99, which is a crowdsourced organization with 10,000 members who all pay about an average, I think, of 50 shekels monthly membership fee to have these people lobbying for them. It's a public lobby. It's the only one of its kind in the world. And she's actually pushing a lot of this in Knesset committees. And what's fascinating is that when she walks into a Knesset economy committee, for example, and she says things like, the government lowered taxes on electric cars in order to make them cheaper, there's 100% import tax on cars. And there's only, I think, a 17%, the VAT tax on electric cars. So electric cars should be much cheaper. But electric cars have a problem. The importers of cars in this country own the large networks of repair shops. And electric cars don't break down enough. They don't actually produce enough spare parts sales like gas cars. And so they want to keep people buying gas cars. And so even though the government tax disappeared on electric cars as an environmental measure and as a measure to lower, you know, the amount of times the cars break down on the roads, they have actually artificially just added tens of thousands of shekels to the price of electric cars in order to make them uncompetitive. And my wife's said this in the Knesset Economy Committee, I think 2-3 weeks ago, as one of these. It's a very similar kind of, you know, very few importers control a very large segment of the economy and they could do whatever they want. And they're not competitive. And she said this, and the Knesset members were shocked. The newspapers were shocked. This is a kind of a black hole. People have not understood how the system works from the inside. Now, once you see it everywhere. It's not complicated. A major reform over the last 2 years, partly pushed by Lobby 99, by my wife's organization, partly pushed by the finance ministry itself, who want to free up the market, the budgets department and the planners and the finance ministry. And what they pushed is a reform that is trying to lower all of these standards requirements and all of these unique standards that Israel imposes on products where it doesn't make any sense.
So, Chaviv, my question is as follows. If they can jack up the prices because they feel like it, then I imagine they can also lower the prices as they're pushed to do so. Is this the kind of thing that we can hope to see in the future? Meaning, if as these standards fall away, as the politicians get involved, is there hope that the cost of living will actually go down despite supply chains, despite Ukraine, etc.?
We might not be able to get prices down to, you know, the American Midwest, where, you know, you're surrounded by massive populations and markets and trucks can drive freely anywhere they want. But we should be able to open up to the prices of New Zealand. If New Zealand's prices, if we can't meet New Zealand's prices, then this is an anti-competitive situation. So, yes, you have to lower all of these standards. We have standards that are preclude the import of French diapers. Now, babies in Paris do not have different poop from babies in Tel Aviv. And so that is not a reasonable standard. And if we just need to do away, somebody needs to take a gigantic axe and do away with all these ridiculous protectionist standards. And then we will see a real result on the ground. And until then, it's every 6 months consumer boycott.
It's really, really interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing how this pans out, hopefully without too much bite in the pocketbook. Okay, now we're going to take a break. When we come back, Sue will fill us in on some recent efforts to improve our environment.
I got married this Monday. in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Daily Briefing listeners. I'm so happy you've joined us for our daily analysis of what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world. Like what you hear? Check out our Times Will Tell weekly podcast. Every Friday, you can hear conversations with authors, artists, archaeologists, and thought leaders from around the globe. Subscribe to Times Will Tell, our weekly half-hour feature, wherever you find your podcasts. Enjoy!
We are back. Sue, explain what carbon sequestration from the air is and why it's important that satellite data is being used to measure it.
Okay, so as we all know, or most of us know, or I hope most of us know, the emission of carbon dioxide into the air, or the excessive emission of carbon dioxide into the air, is what is mainly causing global warming. And so as well as cutting emissions, which most of the countries in the world are now committed to, we need to also take it out of the air, and that's called carbon sequestration. I want to focus on a company that's actually measuring the amount of CO2 that's taken from the atmosphere, because carbon today is worth money in the form of carbon credits. That means that if a factory, for example, has to emit a certain kind of carbon, it can offset it by paying a project that, for example, preserves a forest or preserves a wetland. All biomass, which is all the material that makes up the trees and makes us up and makes all living things up, is actually carbon-based. So you want to trap as much carbon as possible in biomass, which, of course, is what nature's been doing for millions of years. It's part of the so-called carbon cycle. So as I say, the owners of a forest or a peatland or a wetland will be able to, and already being able to, legitimately offer carbon credits to these companies and even to governments. But in order for them to do that, the carbon held needs to be measured according to international standards, and it needs to be monitored. So that, for example, if you generate carbon credits from a forest, you have to make sure that the forest doesn't burn down after 10 years, because if it does, it releases that carbon dioxide back into the air. So I've been speaking to a company called Albo Climate. It's an Israeli company. It was established by a man called Dr. Jachem Amsalem, who actually founded the company to use satellite data and artificial intelligence to locate where mosquitoes are breeding to help eliminate horrible diseases such as Zika. It was decided that the satellite technology should be focused on climate. Now, what happens today is that most people, you know, if they want to report on how much carbon dioxide they have, say, in a forest, they go out and they collect soil samples and they measure the diameter of the trees and what have you, and they send the information to labs, and it takes an awfully long time and it's very expensive. Albo is cutting through all of this because its satellite, it's able, through its artificial intelligence and all this satellite data, to get information that allows it to measure the amount of carbon there is above ground and below ground to a depth of 30 centimetres. And now it's also developing a way to measure carbon in the sea. So they're combining this data and AI to be able to map in an extraordinarily clear way where carbon is being sequestered and how much. I have a horrible feeling that a bidding war will go on and that the oil companies will try to pay more than the credits, and that might become an issue.
That's really, really interesting. Closer to home, what's happening on Derech Chavron? That's the Hebron Road in Jerusalem. It's on a diet?
Well, the idea is to put it on a diet. And it's the brainchild of a man called Yossi Seidov, who is pretty well known in the kind of climate environment community. He's a Jerusalemite who's made it his goal in life to essentially turn the transport pyramid upside down and put pedestrians and cyclists at the top, followed by public transportation. He has a number of victories under his belt, including Parque Mesila, the train tracks park in southern Jerusalem, which follows the route of the old Ottoman train tracks. It incorporates a pedestrian path with cycling lanes, green lawns where lots and lots of people sit, trees, and a very, very narrow road. He's got various other successes under his belt as well. And the latest one is to diet the Hebron Road. The Hebron Road is currently a 5-lane intercity road. It's actually part of Route 60 that goes from Beersheba in the south right up to Nazareth in the north. This is an urban section. And the current situation is that there are 5 lanes, 2 going north, 2 going south, with a bus lane in the middle, which is absolutely balmy because it's actually contributed to the Hebron Road being one of the top 10 most dangerous roads in the country for traffic fatalities, because people get off the bus and then they have to cross 2 lanes to get to the pavement. That bus lane is going to be changed by the Blue Line, which is a light rail line. And what he says, and he quotes loads and loads of international research, road dieting has actually been implemented in a lot of American states and also a lot of European cities. And the research shows that it reduces accidents, it allocates space more fairly, it slows traffic, and it increases quality of life and economic activity. What does it mean, dieting? Under Yossi Seidov's plan, the western 2 lanes, the ones nearest to Baca, will be converted into green space, incorporating cycle paths, running paths, walking paths, cafes, space for community activities, commercial space, might be for shops, might be for cafes, whatever. And on the eastern side, on the Abu Tor and Talpiot side, there will be 2 lanes, 1 going north and 1 going south. The idea is to make the Hebron Road a pilot for something that can spread throughout the whole of the country.
It's going to be a big change for Jerusalem if and when it ever happens. That's it for today's Daily Briefing. Thank you, Chaviv. Thank you, Sue. So glad to have had this time with you.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time.
Shalom.